Last week we finished the 14 unwholesome mental factors. And so today we will study the beautiful mental factors or sobhana chetasikas. Actually, the name sobhana is the name of mental states, I mean mental factors. Originally, it is the name of mental factors. And when consciousness is accompanied by these beautiful or sobhana mental factors, then that consciousness is called a beautiful consciousness. So originally, the name is of chetasikas, mental factors. And there are altogether 25 beautiful mental factors. And these are divided into how many groups? Four. The first 19 are called universal beautiful factors. That means these mental factors will arise with every beautiful consciousness. So they are common to all beautiful consciousness. You remember the beautiful consciousness? Which are the beautiful consciousness? We don't have a chart here. Except what? All types of consciousness except akusala and ahiduka, right? So that means sense sphere, beautiful sense sphere consciousness, then rupavachara consciousness, arupavachara consciousness, and lokutra, supramundane consciousness. So these chetasikas, these 19 chetasikas, will accompany every one of those 59 types of consciousness. And then there is another group, three of them, and what are they? Abstinences. And then two as a group, limitless ones. And then the last one is just single one, faculty of wisdom. So we will study one of them. So the first one is saddha, and it is translated as faith or confidence. Sometimes we use confidence rather than faith, because faith may imply some blind faith, not accompanied by understanding. But here, faith means confidence, and it is mostly accompanied by understanding. So the first, this beautiful chetasika, which is saddha or faith, has the characteristic of placing faith or of trusting. Now, there are four aspects for each mental factor. So the first one is characteristic, and the second, function, the third, manifestation, and the fourth, proximate cause. So when we study mental factors, and not only mental factors, when we study the subjects in Abhidhamma, we try to understand them with reference to these four aspects. Now, if you cannot get all of them, memorize all of them, just try to memorize the first one, characteristic, because it is important. We must know the characteristic of each mental state. So faith or sadda has the characteristic of placing faith or of trusting. That means having faith in something, having faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and so on. And its function is to clarify, as a water clearing gem causes muddy water to become clear. Now, it is explained in the Atthasalini and also in Milindapanya that a universal monarch has that gem as a treasure. And that gem has a quality to clarify water. So suppose he went out fighting, and then he was tired, and he wanted to drink water. And then he told his followers that he wanted to drink water, but the water at that time may be muddy because they have crossed the river. Then when there is the gem with him, then he could easily put the gem in the water, and the impurities will subside and the water will become clear. So when saddha arises in our mind, then our minds become clear. So its function is to clarify, to cleanse the mind, like a water clearing gem. Or its function is to set forth, as one might set forth to cross a flood. Now, set forth really means going right into, plunging into, entering into. Here, the commentaries explain with a simile. See, people were trying to cross a river, but the river was full of crocodiles and other, animals, so that it is not safe. And so these people, who are not brave enough, were just standing on the bank, and then looking at here and there. Then a man will come, a brave man, and ask them what they were doing. And they said, we want to cross the river, but we are afraid of the crocodiles and others. Then he would take up his sword, and then, just follow me, he said. And then he plunged into the river. He got into the river and he went ahead of them, scaring away the crocodiles and others with his sword. And so he safely took the man from this bank to the other bank, and the man from the other bank to this bank. So with the help of that man, or following that man, people were able to cross the stream, cross the river, cross the flood. So in the same way, when there is saddha, then you can do good deeds, meritorious deeds. When you have confidence, when you have faith, say in the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, in the training, and say in yourself, then you can do things. So saddha is like a brave man who takes people to cross the river or the flood, which is full of crocodiles and others. And it is manifested as non-fogginess. So when mind is clear, it is not foggy. That is the removal of the mind's impurities. And it is also manifested as resolution. Now, you have met a dhimokkha, right? There is a mental factor called a dhimokkha. Can you find that chetisika? So among the six variables, occasionals, right? Among the six occasionals, vitakka, vichara, adhimokkha. So there adhimokkha is resolution, right? So determining. And there adhimokkha is occasional and it is variable. So it may accompany both wholesome and unwholesome types of consciousness. Now, in faith or in saddha, there is an element of resolution. So we must understand there are two kinds of adimokkhas. The ordinary adimokkha, which is common to both kusala and akusala, and this faith adimokkha. So when you have faith, you have this element of resolution. This is it. This is the thing to to have faith in or something like that. You make a resolution, you decide, and then you follow it. So there is an element of resolution, element of making up your mind, making up a decision in faith or in saddha. So saddha does not mean simply having faith. Having faith is based upon understanding, and when you understand that something is a real object of your faith, then you decide that it is thing. And then you have faith in or you have confidence in it. So there is an element of resolution in saddha. Its proximate cause is something to place faith in. That means the Buddha, Dhamma, or Sangha and others, or hearing of the good Dhamma, etc. That constitute the factors of stream entry. Now, they constitute the factors of stream entry. There are some things that lead to the attainment of Sotapatti Magga and Sotapatti Phala. That is, associating with noble people, listening to the Dhamma. Let me see. And then, wise reflection and practice of Vipassana. So these are called constituent factors of stream entry. So if you want to reach Sotapannahood, then you follow these four things. So associating with noble people or people who are knowledgeable, and then listening to good Dhamma, wise reflection, and practice of Dhamma. So these are the proximate causes of saddha. Now, saddha is compared to many things in the discourses. Saddha is compared to a hand. Now, if you have a hand, then you can pick up the good things you want. Even though you see a heap of treasures in front of you, if you do not have a hand, you cannot pick them up. In the same way, if you do not have saddha, if you do not have confidence, you cannot pick up kusala. You cannot pick up good qualities, good mental, good mental states. So saddha is compared to a hand. And also saddha is described as a treasure. There are treasures which are called noble treasure. Saddha is one of them. And saddha treasure can lead to the attainment of enlightenment. And so it is the best of treasures. The ordinary treasures cannot help us to reach the state of to reach a state of arahantship or enlightenment. But saddha can help us in reaching that state. Because without saddha, without confidence, we will not even listen to the Dhamma, we will not even practice meditation. So saddha is compared to a treasure, a wealth. And also saddha is compared to a seed. If you want to have a tree and fruit, you must grow the seed. If you do not have a seed, you cannot have tree and you cannot have fruits and flowers. So in the same way, if you do not have saddha, then you cannot have good got eggs, you cannot have kusala. So sadha is sometimes compared to a seed. And sadha is among the five mental faculties. You remember the five mental faculties. What are these? Faith, mindfulness, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So faith or sadha is one of the mental faculties. And these five mental faculties are to be kept in balance. Right? You understand that? If any one of them is in excess, your meditation will go wrong. So sadha is to be balanced especially with panya, understanding. Too much sadha and you will believe in anything. Too much panya and you will become deceitful. If you know too much, you become deceitful. So sadha is one of the five mental faculties which are important in the practice of meditation. Okay, the next one is what? Sati, mindfulness. You all know mindfulness. You have been practicing mindfulness for many, many years now. So mindfulness, the Pali word for mindfulness is sati. And sati is derived from a root meaning to remember. But here, as a mental factor, it is not remembering, actually, but presence of mind, attentiveness to the present. So rather than the faculty of memory regarding the past. So sati here means not remembering, but to pay attention to the object at the present moment. So when you practice satipatthana, mindfulness meditation, you just do that. Be mindful of the object at the present moment. But in some places, sati means remembering. Now, the supernormal knowledge of remembering past lives, you know, Buddha attained this knowledge in the first watch of the night before he became the Buddha. So that knowledge is called Pubbe Niwasa no Sati. Now there is Sati. So Sati there means to remember. He was able to remember his past lives. So in those contexts, Sati can mean remembering. But here as a Chetisika, Sati means not remembering, but say mindfulness, to be with the object. And its characteristic is not wobbling. That means not floating on the surface. The commentary explains that some, say, dry gourd, or let us say a balloon or something, you put it on the water and it floats on the water. It does not go into the water. So sati is not like that. Sati must go into the object, enter the object. That is why another way of saying non-wobbling is non-superficiality. So if it must be sati, it must not be superficial. It must be squarely with the object. It must go into the object. Its function is absence of confusion or non-forgetfulness. That means actually not losing the object. Its function. So when you pay attention to something, your mind is with that object. Your mind does not lose that object. And your mind does not lose the object because there is sati there with it. So it has the function of non-forgetting or not losing the object. It is manifested as guardianship or manifested as a guard. Now, when you put a guard at the gate, the guard can keep out unwanted elements, unwanted people. In the same way, when you put Siddhi as a guard at your mind door, it can keep out unwholesome mental states from entering your mind. So when yogis concentrate on Siddhi itself, then it appears to them as a guard. So Siddhi is there at the six doors, sense doors, and so long as there is Siddhi at these doors, no unwholesome mental state can enter the mind. Now, that is why Buddha said, this is the only way for the purification of beings. Now, many people, especially in the West, do not like that statement. They always say, there must be some other ways also, not just this only. So the other day I met a woman who said, I don't like the saying, see, this is the only way or this is the only method. I didn't say anything to her. Now, that is true, that this mindfulness is the only way to keep the mental defilements from entering your mind. There is no other way. You try it. You keep mindfulness with you, and then you can keep them at bay. The moment you lose mindfulness, they come in. So mindfulness is the only way that we must accept. Buddha expressly said that. This is the only way. There is no other way. But mindfulness can be practiced in different ways. Mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of postures of the body, mindfulness of small activities, mindfulness of elements, four elements in the body, mindfulness of different parts of the body. So there are many kinds of mindfulness practices. But whatever you practice, it must be mindfulness, so that it can keep the mental defilements away from your mind. That is why Buddha said, this is the only way for the purification of minds of beings. So it is like a guard. So long as there is the mindfulness guard at the door, at the six sense doors, there will be no chance for mental defilements to enter your mind. Or it manifests as the state of confronting an objective field. That means turning to the object or something like that. When there is Siddhi, then mind is not only aimed at the object, actually mind is in touch with the object. So it is turning the mind towards the object, something like that. So confronting means coming face to face with the object. Its proximate cause is strong perception. If you have strong sanya, you can remember many things. You can memorize a book, or maybe many books. And actually, that is because you have strong sanya. And strong sanya helps you remember things. Or the four foundations of mindfulness are its proximate cause. So you practice four foundations of mindfulness and you develop mindfulness. So the former mindfulness, the previous mindfulness is a proximate cause or a condition for the succeeding mindfulness. So one moment of mindfulness helps another moment of mindfulness, another moment of mindfulness. So that is why it is said, four foundations of mindfulness are its proximate cause. Okay, next two, Hiri and Ottappa. So hiri is the shame of wrongdoing, and ottaba is the fear of wrongdoing. We met the opposite of these two among the 14 unwholesome mental factors. So they are ahirika and anottaba. Here we left out the negative particles, and so we get hiri and ottaba. So hiri is shame. Shame for wrongdoing, or disgust for wrongdoing. And ottaba is fear of wrongdoing. So shame has a characteristic of disgust at bodily and verbal misconduct. Fear of wrongdoing has the characteristic of dread in regard to such misconduct. They both have the function of not doing evil and are manifested as a shrinking away from evil. So when you have hiri and ottaba, you do not do evil. You do not do akusala. So that means you shrink away from akusala. You keep yourself away from akusala. The approximate cause is respect for self and respect for others, respectively. Shame or hiri, the proximate cause of hiri is respect for oneself. And proximate cause of fear or ottaba is respect for others. That means, if say I want to do something, some evil, say I will say to myself, oh, such a person as I should not do this. Say, I come from a good family, I am the student of, say, great teachers, and say, I have been, say, a monk for many years, and so such a person as I should not do such an evil. And so, considering for myself, I refrain from doing evil. So that is hiri. Ottaba is, if I do something wrong, people will blame me. I will lose face with them. So I'm afraid of being criticized by you. So I refrain from doing evil because I fear criticism. So that is respect for others, not respect for myself. So respect for oneself is the proximate cause of hiri, shame for wrongdoing, and respect for others is proximate cause of ottaba. These two states are called by the Buddha the guardians of the world because they protect the world from falling into widespread immorality. If there were no hiri and ottaba in the world, then there would be, as it is said in the book, widespread immorality. So these two qualities, say these two mental factors, are those that keep the society in good shape. Once society gives up these two qualities, have no respect for these two qualities, then society becomes wild, immoral. So Buddha described these two as, in Pali, they are called lokapala. So loka means world and pala means protecting, so or guarding. So guardians of the world, lokapala. But sometimes you are ashamed to do something good, and that is not hiri. Right? So here hiri is shame, but shame for doing evil. And so the shame to do good things is not hiri, not the real hiri. Okay, the next one is alobha, non-greed. It is the opposite of lobha. opposite is lobha is attachment, and so alobha is non-attachment. Non-greed has the characteristic of the mind's lack of desire for its object. So even though the object is presented to it, it is not interested in it. It is it has no desire, say, to possess that object, to be attached to that object. So that is alobha. Or its characteristic is non-adherence to the object, like a drop of water on the lotus leaf. Very good example. So you put a drop of water on the lotus leaf and it immediately falls away. So when there is non-greed, alobha, then your mind will not be attached to anything at all, anybody or anything at all. So it is like a drop of water on it. Its function is not to lay hold, not to take hold of something, not to cling to something, and its manifestation is just detachment. It should be understood that non-greed is not the mere absence of greed, but that is very important, because some authors translate it as absence of greed. It is not absence of greed. If it is absence of greed, it must be panyati. It must be a concept. It is not a reality. Like absence of first arupa vajra consciousness. So alobha does not mean absence of lobha, but something which is the opposite of lobha. So it is actually a positive mental state, a positive virtue, such as generosity and renunciation as well. So it is not the mere absence of greed, but it is a positive state, positive mental virtue, which manifests in generosity and renunciation and others. The next one is adosa. Here also, it is not the absence of dosa, not the absence of hatred. Now, it has a characteristic of lack of ferocity. Dosa is fierce, right? Dosa is rough. Dosa is fierce. And it is the opposite of dosa. So it is, its characteristic is lack of ferocity or of non-opposing. So when there is dosa, there is opposition between the object and the mind. But here, adosa, it is adosa, and so there is no opposition. Its function is to remove annoyance or to remove fever. So fever means fever of mind. When there is dosa, mind is said to be feverish. And so it removes that fever. And its manifestation is agreeableness. Non-hatred comprises such positive virtues as loving-kindness, gentleness, amity, friendliness, etc. So, which is the opposite of dosa, which is opposite of hate, opposite of anger, is adosa. Now, this adosa appears as the sublime quality of loving-kindness. Now, when you practice loving-kindness, loving kindness is actually adosa. But not every adosa is loving kindness. So loving kindness is narrower in scope than adosa. Only when you practice saying, "May all beings be happy," is there loving kindness. Now you are studying, or you may be thinking of the Buddha. At that moment, there is no loving kindness, but there is adosa in your mind. So only when you deliberately develop this desire for the well-being of all beings, like may all beings, saying may all beings be well and happy, only then is it called loving kindness. So the loving kindness is in essence adosa, but not all adosa is loving kindness. So you have to specially develop it. So when it becomes loving kindness, it has the characteristic of promoting the welfare of living beings. That means the desire for the welfare of all beings. Its function is to prefer their welfare. Its manifestation is the removal of ill will. So when you practice loving kindness, you remove or you get rid of anger, you get rid of ill will. Its proximate cause is seeing beings as lovable. Such loving kindness must be distinguished from selfish affection, its near enemy. Now, when you practice loving kindness, you have to be careful of two enemies, the near enemy and the far enemy. The far enemy is not difficult to see and not difficult to get rid of. The far enemy is hate, anger, opposite, direct enemy. But the near enemy is affection, love. Sometimes it is very difficult to distinguish loving kindness from, say, love. Now, a mother has love for her child. That love for her child, what do you think? Is it raga or is it metta? I think both. Right? Sometimes it may be raga, and sometimes it is pure loving kindness. Once a woman told me, I had a granddaughter and I'm sending loving kindness thoughts to her, she said. But I thought what she was sending was not loving, pure loving kindness, but a kind of attachment. So this attachment comes to us in the guise of loving kindness. That is why it is called near enemy. It is more difficult to see than the far enemy, say, which is dosa. We can easily see that dosa is the enemy of metta. But this selfish affection or attachment is not so easy to see. So it is called near enemy. So when we practice loving kindness meditation, we must be careful that we do not get into the hands of this near enemy. When practicing loving kindness meditation, when you are sending loving kindness thoughts to specific persons, it is instructed in Visuddhimagga that you are not to send thoughts to a person of opposite sex, because affection or lust can arise out of that the development of loving kindness towards the person of opposite sex. So while practicing loving kindness meditation, we must take care that we do not get into the near enemy, say, which is affection, which is lust, say, which is attachment. The next one has a long name. Tatra Majjatata. The Pali term for this chetasika literally means there in the middleness. I think there should be hyphens between those words. There in the middleness. That means there means among the chetasikas. It is impartial. It is neutral. When you are in the middle, say, you do not fall into either group, and so you are impartial, you are neutral. It is a synonym for equanimity upekkha, not as neutral feeling, but as a mental attitude of balance, detachment, and impartiality. Now, whenever you find the word upekkha, be careful. It can mean the feeling upekkha, neutral feeling, neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. And also it can mean this mental factor, which is neutrality of mind. It is not feeling. Vedana is feeling, right? Yeah. And upekkha feeling is one of the five kinds of feelings. But this upekkha is not vedana, not feeling. It is a mental state which is called the neutrality of mind. So many people have been misled by the word upekkha. So you be careful when you read books and when you find the word upekkha, try to find out what it means in that context. So it is a synonym for equanimity, not as a neutral feeling, but as a mental attitude of balance, detachment, and impartiality. It has the characteristic of conveying consciousness and the mental factors evenly. That means, now, consciousness and mental factors arise together, right? Arise at the same time. And they must do their respective functions. And for them to do their respective functions properly, they need this kind of, this mental factor. It's like supervisor. But it is compared to a charioteer, a driver, who drives the cart drawn by the two horses or four horses. When the horses are running evenly, then the driver doesn't have to make much effort to keep the carriage going. So this mental factor keeps consciousness and other mental factors going properly. And when under its regulation, consciousness and mental factors are going properly, it is a kind of neutrality there. It doesn't have to make much effort. Its function is to prevent deficiency and excess. Now, in doing their respective functions, sometimes they may do functions in excess, or sometimes they may not do their functions well. So if they do not do their functions well or they overfunction, then the balance of this mental makeup will be disturbed. So this mental state prevents or, say, regulates the functions of associated other mental states going smoothly. Or its function is to prevent partiality, not to fall into this side or that side. It is manifested as neutrality. It should be seen as a state of looking on with equanimity in the Chaita and Chaitasikas, like a charioteer who looks on with equanimity at the thoroughbreds progressing evenly along the roadway. So I always compare this to cruise control, right, in your car. So when you put the cruise control on, you don't have to make much effort for the car to be going. So there is a kind of tatra majadada there. Now, this neutrality of mind becomes the sublime quality of equanimity towards living beings. That means there are four Brahma viharas, four sublime states, four abodes of the Brahmas. And among them, there is what? Upekkha, right? There are four Brahma viharas. The first one is metta, loving kindness. Second one is karuna, compassion. The third one is mudita, sympathetic joy. And the fourth one is equanimity. That equanimity is called upekkha in Pali, and that upekkha is this tatra majadada, and not feeling upekkha. As such, it treats beings free from discrimination, without preferences and prejudices, looking upon all as equal. This equanimity should not be confused with its near enemy, the worldly-minded indifference due to ignorance. That means not paying attention totally. In that case, that is not knowing. That is ignorance. So, the upekkha here is not turning away from the object. It is with the object, but it does not fall into partiality. So its near enemy is this worldly-minded indifference due to ignorance. That is something like careless attitude. Now, for when, say, a son behaves bad and does not listen to his parents' advice or admonition, sometimes parents may say, I will practice ubhikha to watch you. I will not be concerned about you. Whatever happens to you, I will not be affected or something like that. So that kind of thing is not this ubhikha. That is turning yourself away from that object. But ubhikha is that which takes the object but treats it with impartiality. Then we have what? The next 12 universal beautiful chetisikas fall into 6 pairs. Now comes the pairs. Each containing one term that extends to the mental body, kaya, and another that extends to consciousness, cheta. In this context, the mental body is the collection of associated chetisikas called body in the sense of an aggregation. Now, the first pair is kaya pasadhi and chitta pasadhi. Pasadhi means tranquility, calm. And kaya here means not the usual meaning of body, our physical body. But kaya here means an aggregation, a combination. Or in other words, kaya here means namakaya. And namakaya means simply the chetisikas. So actually kaya here means the chetisikas. So kaya pasadhi means tranquility of chetisikas, actually. Or you can just say tranquility of namakaya, mental body. And chitta pasadhi means tranquility of consciousness. So the first one is the tranquility of chetisikas, and the second one is the tranquility of chitta. The twofold tranquility has the characteristic of quieting down of disturbances in the mental body and consciousness, respectively. Its function is to crush such disturbances. It is manifested as peacefulness and coolness. So when there is kaya pasadhi and chitta pasadhi, you feel peaceful. Its proximate cause is the mental body and consciousness. It should be regarded as opposed to such defilements as restlessness and worry. So when there is restlessness and worry in your mind, you do not have tranquility of mind and tranquility of mental body and tranquility of chitta. The second pair, kaya lahuta and chitta lahuta. Lahu means light. So lahuda means lightness, lightness of the body, lightness of the chetisikas, and lightness of consciousness. So when there is lightness, there is no heaviness. So their characteristic is subsiding of heaviness in the mental body and consciousness, respectively. Its function is to crush heaviness. It is manifested as non-sluggishness. Its proximate cause the same, mental body and consciousness. It should be regarded as opposed to such defilements as sloth and torpor, which create heaviness. So when there is sloth and torpor, you become heavy. Your eyelids become heavy, and then they overpower you, and you become like a very heavy thing. But when you are alert, when you are healthy, then you feel that lightness in your body and in your mind. Now the third group, the third pair is kaya mudita and citta mudita. The literal meaning of mudita is softness. But softness here means malleability. It means they are not rigid. So they are, what do you call that? Compliant? Can I say compliant? Yeah. So they have the characteristic of subsiding of rigidity. So they are not rigid when they are soft. And it should be regarded as opposed to such defilements as wrong views and conceit. Now, when there is a wrong view, you are very stubborn. You don't want to give up your view easily, right? And when you are conceited, when you have pride, that you are rigid, you are stiff, something like that. So when you have mana, the conceit, you don't want to bow down, or you don't want to let other people say get their way, and so they are rigid mental states. So this pair is the opposite of these mental states, and so they are called mudita, softness, malleability. The next pair is kaya kammanyata and citta kammanyata. Wieldiness. The twofold wieldiness are the characteristic of subsiding of unwieldiness. It doesn't help much, right? Sometimes the explanations are like that. Now, wieldiness means you can do what you like with it. The simile given here is gold. Now, when gold is purified and treated, it becomes, how to call, wieldy. It becomes pliable. You can shape gold into anything without there being resistance in gold. But if the gold is hard, it may not lend itself to be made into different ornaments. So first, a goldsmith has to purify gold by treating it with fire or something. And then when it becomes pliant, then you can make it into any ornament you like. So the state of such thing is called wieldiness, kammanyata. So it is agreeable to being shaped or agreeable to being made into anything. That's right. So when I read that malleability, I had that in mind. Sometimes it is difficult to get, say, the satisfactory word for the Pali words. So I would use softness rather than malleability for mudita. So that I think that's better. So, and their function is to crush unwieldiness and manifest a success of the mental body and consciousness in making something an object. Its proximate cause is the mental body and consciousness. It should be regarded as opposed to the remaining hindrance, which create unwieldiness of the mental body and consciousness. Now the next pair is kaya pagunyata and citta pagunyata. The twofold proficiency. Now, this word is also has a little problem. Now, this pagunyata comes from paguna. And paguna has, say, three meanings. One is straight, But that is not needed here, because straightness will come later. And the other is proficiency. Proficiency means being familiar with. Now, if I am familiar with a book, I can say I am paguna with this book. That means I know this book well, thoroughly. And then there is another meaning, that is being in a good state, being in a good condition. And I think that will fit here. Because when you read the characteristic, you see the characteristic of healthiness of mental body and consciousness. Healthiness. So I think we can call it fitness, right? Nowadays, fitness means to be healthy, right? Yeah. So the kaya pagonyada, although it is translated as proficiency, it is, I think, healthiness. Healthiness of chetasikas and healthiness of cheta. So its function is to crush unhealthiness and so on. So it should be regarded as opposed to lack of faith, etc. So when you do not have faith, you do not have mindfulness and so on, your mind is with a kind of disease. So your mind is not healthy. So it is opposed to lack of faith and so on. The last pair is ujjukata. Uju means straight. So ujjukata means straightness, rectitude, straightness of mental body, straightness of consciousness. So it has a characteristic of uprightness of mental body and consciousness, respectively, and its function is to crush tortuousness of the mental body and consciousness, and its manifestation is non-crookedness. Like when there are unwholesome state in the mind, mind is said to be in a bad shape, mind is said to be crooked. So mind is considered not to be straight. So it manifests itself as non-crookedness. Its proximate cause is the same, mental body and consciousness. It should be regarded as opposed to hypocrisy and fraudulence, etc., which create crookedness in the mind, mental body, and consciousness. So it is the opposite of, say, hypocrisy, fraudulence, deceit, and so on. Now, these mental states are mentioned in pairs here. And the explanation given in the commentaries is why they are formed into pairs, while others are mentioned separately, like saddha and sati, so on. They are separate, or single. But here they are in pairs. And the explanation given is they crush their opposite qualities when they are together. And that is why they are grouped together as pairs here. And also another explanation is that rectitude of mental states and rectitude of mind, right? I mean, right, rectitude of consciousness. So rectitude of consciousness is just the straightness of consciousness. But rectitude of kaya can imply also the rectitude of physical body. When there is rectitude of mind, I mean, rectitude of mental states, there is also rectitude of kaya, I mean, physical body. When there is, say, tranquility in the mind, then your physical body is also tranquil. So, in order to show that they are described in pairs, kaya pasadi and citta pasadi, and so on. And so these 19 mental factors will arise with every type of sobhana consciousness. Then we go to the next group, And they are called virati, abstinences. And they are samma vacha, right speech, samma kammanta, right action, and samma ajiva, right livelihood. You are very familiar with these three mental factors because they are included in the eight factors of the Noble Path. So among the Eightfold Noble Path, the constituents of Eightfold Noble Path, you find these three mental factors, samma vacha, samma kammanta, samma ajiva, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And these three are collectively called what? Virati, abstinences. Abstinence from what? Wrong conduct. So abstinence from wrong conduct by bodily actions, abstinence from wrong conduct by speech or verbal actions, and abstinence from wrong livelihood. So they arise only when a person really abstains from, say, let's say killing, really abstains from stealing. So when you are studying like this, or when you are paying homage to the Buddha, when you are, say, chanting or something, then there is no virati present in your mind. So these abstinences arise in your mind only when you deliberately abstain from wrongdoing. Now, there are three kinds of virati mentioned in the commentaries. So here, the first one is called natural abstinence. I think we should say abstinence on occasion. The second is abstinence by undertaking precepts. And the third is abstinence by eradication of mental defilements. So there are three types of virati, three types of abstinences. The first one is called sampatta virati. Sampatta really means arrived. So some occasion arrived or reaches you, and then you refrain from doing wrong. Then there is this virati. Here, the abstention is done not because one has taken precepts. It just happened to be there, and then the person refrains from it. Considering one's social position, age, level of education, etc., such a person as I should not do this or something like that. An example is refraining from theft out of concern that one's reputation would be hurt if one is caught. So, see, there is an occasion for a man, he can pick it up easily, but he may say to himself, such a person as I, belonging to this social position or something, should not do this. And so he refrains from taking it, he refrains from killing it. So at that time, there is abstinence of samma kammanta, right action. And when there is an occasion for telling a lie, and then you refrain from it, considering your social position and so on, then there is samma vacha, abstinence, which is called right speech. And when you abstain from the wrong conduct, bodily conduct and verbal conduct, which is your livelihood, then there is samma ajiva. So samma vacha, samma kammanta on the one hand, and samma ajiva on the other hand. They are just abstinences. from wrongdoings. But the difference is, if the abstinence from, if the wrongdoing is one's livelihood, then the abstinence from that is called sama ajiwa. If it is not so, it is called sama wacha or sama kamanda. If a fisherman abstains from killing fish, then that is sama ajiwa, right livelihood, because killing fish is his livelihood. If a man refrains from fishing as a hobby, then there is sama kamanda and not sama ajiwa, because fishing is not his livelihood. He just do it for fun or for pleasure. So when abstaining when occasion arises is called sampatta viriti. And in the commentary, in the Atthasalini, a story is given to illustrate this. Now, there was a mother and her sons. The mother had a disease, and the physicians told her that he needed the raw flesh. It's called wet flesh. The raw flesh of a rabbit to cure that disease. So when the doctor told this, the elder brother sent the younger brother to the forest to get a rabbit. So the younger brother went into the forest. And then there was a rabbit. And when the rabbit heard the man coming, it ran away. But when it ran away, it was caught in the creepers. So when it was caught, it makes noise like creak, creak, creak or something like that. So he went there and he caught the rabbit. And then he thought to himself, I cannot kill this rabbit. I cannot take the life of this rabbit just to cure the disease of my mother. So he let it go and then went back. The elder brother, when he saw him, asked him, have you got the rabbit? And he said, he told the story. See, I caught the rabbit, but I didn't want to kill it just for the sake of curing the disease of my mother, so I let it go. So his brother scolded him. But he went to his mother, and then he made an asseveration of truth. He said, ever since I become, how to call that, knowledgeable. Say, ever since I know what is right and what is wrong, I have never taken the life of any living being. By the asseveration of this truth, by saying this truth, may the disease of my mother be healed. And then it is said that the disease was healed. So that kind of abstention is called sampatta viriti. Abstention when occasion arises. He didn't take any precepts. He hadn't taken any precepts before he went out. But there was an occasion to kill a rabbit, and then he didn't do it. He abstained from killing it. So that kind of viriti or abstinence is called sampatta viriti. So abstinence on occasion. The second one is abstinence by undertaking precepts. Samadhana viriti. Samadhana means taking. So abstinence because of taking precepts. It's the abstinence from evil deeds because one has undertaken to observe precepts. For example, the five precepts of abstaining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and intoxicants. There's a story. This time, there was a farmer. One day he went out to his field and to work in the field. Then his cow, maybe his cattle, his ox, got lost. So he went in the forest in search of his ox. And then maybe a big snake, a python, caught him. So when the python coiled around him, he had something like a sword in his hand. So he thought, wait a minute. Before going out to the forest to work, he went to a renowned monk and took precepts from that monk. So after taking the precepts, 5 precepts, he went to work in the fields. So he was caught by the snake. And so he thought, I will cut the head of this snake with this sword. And then he thought to himself, I have taken precepts from such a holy monk, so I should not break my precepts. Then again he thought, I will kill this snake with my sword. And then he again said, it's not proper for me to break the precepts since I have taken it from so holy a monk. So 3 times he thought this way. And after thinking this 3 times, he said, let the snake kill me if he wants to. I will not kill him. And then he threw the sword away. So at that moment, the snake uncoiled his body around him and then went away. So he was saved. He did not die. So he kept the precept of not killing because he had taken precepts from the monk. So that kind of abstention is called samadana viridhi. Abstention because one has taken precepts. And then the last one is called samuccheda viridhi. And that is abstention that is accomplished at the moment when mental defilements are eradicated. When are the mental defilements eradicated? At the moment of enlightenment, right? So, at the moment of enlightenment, mental defilements are eradicated. When the mental defilements are eradicated, the dispositions towards evil deeds is also eradicated. Since even the dispositions towards evil deeds are eradicated, abstention from all evil deeds is accomplished. Although there is no occasion, although he may have not taken precepts, but since he has eradicated mental defilements, he eradicated, along with mental defilements, even the disposition towards doing evil. And so it is said that at that moment of enlightenment, all 3 arise together. So the abstinence is virtually accomplished at that moment, although he may not be abstaining from killing or whatever at that moment, because there is no occasion there. Say a person is sitting in meditation and then he gets enlightenment. So there is no occasion for him to break any of the rules. But since all mental defilements have been eradicated, along with the disposition towards doing evil, along with just thinking about doing evil, the abstinences are said to be virtually accomplished. And so that kind of abstinence is called samuccheda viridhi. Samuccheda means cutting off altogether. Abstinence by cutting mental defilements altogether. So there are 3 types of abstinences. Abstinence on occasion, abstinence because of precepts, undertaking precepts, and abstinence by eradication of mental defilements. So there are three abstinences, and the first is right speech. Right speech really means deliberate abstinence from wrong speech. Now, it is important. Just saying what is true is not abstinence. You say what is true, right? That is not abstinence. Abstinence comes only when you have an occasion to say what is not true and you refrain from saying it. And you may say something which is true. So it is a time when there is right speech. So right speech will not arise always. It will arise only when there is abstinence. Here, abstinence from wrong speech, false speech, abstinence from slander, abstinence from harsh speech, and abstinence from frivolous talk. That means abstinence from talking nonsense. These are the four wrongdoings by speech. So there are four wrongdoings by speech. Telling lie, slandering, using harsh words, and speaking nonsense. The next one is right action, samma kammanta. Here also, deliberate abstinence from wrong bodily action. That means from killing, from stealing, and from sexual misconduct. So, abstinence, when you abstain from killing, etc., there is right action. But when you are paying homage to the Buddha, it is not right action as abstinence. Or it is not abstinence as right action. Although it is right action because you are doing what is right. But that is not called samma kammanta, and abstinence. And the last one is right livelihood, samma ajiva. That is deliberate abstinence from the seven mentioned above. Four wrongdoings by speech and three wrongdoings by body. So abstaining from these seven is right livelihood. Abstinence from wrong livelihood such as dealing in poison and so on. They are also called wrong livelihood. Wrong trades. Dealing in poison, dealing in intoxicants, dealing in weapons, dealing in human beings or slaves, and dealing in animals for slaughter for food. So these are the five that a follower of the Buddha is supposed not to follow, not to do. So only when there is abstinence from wrongdoing, whether they are one's livelihood or not, is there one of these three abstinences, right speech, right action, or right livelihood. So later on we will come to them also. So they do not arise always with sopana chetas. They will arise only sometimes. And they cannot arise three at the same time with kama vajra chetas. But with supramundane chetas, they will arise three simultaneously. So we will study them later. Now the next group is called appamanya. Appamanya means no limit, so limitless, the limitless ones. Why are they called limitless? Because they take limitless beings as objects. When you practice karuna or mudita, or even when you practice metta and upekkha also, you must practice towards all beings. So there must be no limit to the beings to whom you practice one of these four qualities. That is why they are called appamanya. Appamanya means no limit. And also, when you are practicing loving kindness to one person, even when you are practicing to one person, it is called appamanya. It is called limitless. Because when you send thoughts to a person, you do not limit your loving kindness to upper part of the body only or lower part of the body only, but you take the whole being without any restriction as the object. That is why these four are called appamanya. So limitless ones. And the first of them is here, what? Karuna. Karuna is compassion. And karuna has a characteristic of promoting the removal of suffering in others. That means the desire for the removal of suffering in other beings is called karuna. Whether suffering is really removed or not is one thing. But when you practice karuna, you say, may she be free from suffering. May he or she get free from suffering. So whether the person really gets out of suffering or not is another thing. But you do practice that way. And when you practice compassion, it is important that you do not fall prey to its enemy. It succeeds when it causes cruelty to subside, and it fails when it produces sorrow. Now, cruelty is the opposite of karuna. But in practicing karuna, sometimes you may fall into sorrow. You are sorry about those who are suffering. You suffer with them. And when you suffer with them, or sometimes when you are angry with those who inflict injury on those beings, then you step over the boundary of compassion and fall into akusala, fall into sorrow or fall into anger. So compassion in Buddhism, a Buddhist teaching, is purely wholesome. And the moment you experience sorrow or anger, it is no longer karuna. There is no longer karuna in your mind. You are no longer practicing karuna. So it is very important that when you practice karuna, you just stop there and don't go over to suffering with those, or say getting angry with those who inflict pain on them. So there are two enemies here. One direct enemy is cruelty, and near enemy is sorrow. So, and then second one is mudita, appreciative joy or sympathetic joy. That means you are happy when you see other people prosperous, when you see other people in happiness. So that is called mudita, joy. So it has a characteristic of gladness at the success of others. So when other people are successful, when other people are well off, when other people are happy, you are also happy. So that is mudita. It is manifested as the elimination of aversion. Its proximate cause is seeing the success of others. It succeeds when it causes aversion to subside, and it fails when it produces merriment. Now here also, its direct enemy is aversion. That means dislike. It's like jealousy. So when somebody is successful, you don't like it. So that is called aversion here. That is its direct enemy. But the near enemy is merriment. That means, how to call, getting happy, not wholesome happiness. Here, getting merry and, with attachment and so on. So that is a near enemy of mudita. So you, somebody is successful and you are very happy with that, and not just a wholesome happiness, but a merriment comes in, and that is the near enemy of mudita. So karuna and mudita, karuna and mudita are among the four sublime states, or four